Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in studio is Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He has covered military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. His new book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Thank you very much.
When you use the word insurgency, it suggests something fairly dire. Now, we had towards the end of the Bush administration some Pentagon official referring to the U.S.'s future security threats being two failed states, Pakistan and Mexico. And needless to say, that upset a lot of officials in Mexico. Where would you describe it in terms of either a failed state or a state undergoing an insurgency?
Yeah, these are certainly very controversial terms, and this has been a very hot debate about the language. One thing, in Mexico, it's such an extraordinary situation in terms of the violence and in terms of the type of conflict we've seen. And people struggle for words or language to even describe it. No one's really, really sure. What do you call this? What do you call a situation when you have a group of 50 armed men with Kalashnikov rifles and RPGs attacking a police station and they're working for a drug trafficker? What do you call it when you have 200 bodies in a series of pits? What do you call it when you have a militia massacring 72 migrants on their way to the United States? What do you call it when you have the head of the entire federal police murdered his own household, coming home from work and arriving there, and there's an assassin waiting for him? So I use the term criminal insurgency because in this situation, you have groups who have overwhelmed the power of government in many parts of the country. They are in armed rebellion against the military and police forces, and they are capturing parts of the state. In parts of Mexico, they've become like a shadow government. When they take money from businesses, when they go to businesses and say, you have to pay us, and often they take money even from school teachers, they become like a form of predatory shadow government in these areas. Now, some businessmen in Ciudad Juarez at one point said, well, why should we pay tax to the federal government if we're paying off protection money to the drug cartel? They've become, why do we have to pay tax twice? And they have quite a compelling argument. A newspaper in Ciudad Juarez called El Diario, when a reporter was murdered on his lunch break, a young man, a photographer, just beginning his career, was having a lunch break and was shot dead. And the newspaper wrote an editorial addressed to the cartels, but also really addressed to the government of Mexico, saying to the cartels, saying, you cartels are the de facto power in this city. What do you want from us? Tell us what you want. Even in a war, we have to have rules. Very powerful editorial. So I describe the term criminal insurgency to say, this situation has gone way beyond organized crime. It's not just cops and robbers anymore. In the days of Al Capone, the famous Valentine's Day massacre, I believe, was 7 people shot dead. In one massacre in Mexico, we've talked about 72 people.
I guess the two presidents you've sat down with have been Vicente Fox and Felipe Calderon.
Ernesto Zedillo.
And Zedillo as well.
I haven't sat down with interviewed Calderon directly. Okay. I've interviewed Zedillo and Vicente Fox.
So if you were to interview the current president, obviously the questions, he has made a very inflammatory remark recently, suggesting that if the PRI comes back to power, they'll make a deal with the drug cartels. Frankly, I think that's absolutely in the cards because that's the history of the PRI. And probably the Mexican people are so tired of this that they're likely to accede to that kind of deal with the devil?
It's a complicated issue, and sometimes the terms can be a bit deceiving. You know, what really was the pre-strategy towards organized crime? And it's not quite as simple as to say the pre made a deal with organized crime, Felipe Calderón attacks organized crime. During the pre, you had 71 years of government and you had a changing relationship with criminal gangs. Now, even in the United States, you have a certain modus operandi of dealing with organized crime and dealing with drug trafficking in this country. In this country, drugs are sold in every state. In this country, drugs move around the US. In this country, there's neighborhoods all over the nation where people are selling drugs on street corners. But Washington is not ordering military units into these neighborhoods to try and attack the drug trade. It's allowing the drug trade to function. And it's arresting certain traffickers and whatever. It's got a certain kind of modus operandi going on. Now, Felipe Calderón has had a rhetoric of war, of confrontation from when he took office, and has done very large symbolic actions from the beginning of sending the military into neighborhoods, of attacking. And this policy was not successful. Those who defend Calderón's record say it would have been worse still if he hadn't done it. No one says things have got better because things have so obviously gotten worse in the last 4 years. I mean, 40,000 murders, widespread extortion, civilians being hurt by this. The next government that comes in is, in my opinion, inevitably going to have a shift in strategy. Now, it's not, I don't think it's quite as simple as any government these days can just sit down in the presidential palace and say, you know, have the capos come to dinner and make a deal. But there can be a shift in strategy, and I think the PRI or whoever gets into power will shift strategy and say we're going to move away from the confrontation of war and have some kind of being less confrontational about drug trafficking. And Calderón is, obviously, attacking the PRI right now for certain political reasons as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for major international news organizations. And we're talking about the war on drugs next door in Mexico, chronicled in his new book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. But my understanding is that much of the power of the cartels in terms of their political protection and their relationships with politicians comes at the state level. And the state of Guerrero, for example, has been run forever by the Figueroa family, these criminal caciques. And now, of course, it's been run by the PRD, but there's kind of a war going on there. So isn't that, one of the governors down in, was it Tamaulipas or somewhere, disappeared? Is on, literally on the lam? Walk us through that. Is this just a federal problem in Mexico?
Sure. The issue with the local corruption, and like you say, there are a lot of what they call caciques, chiefs, mm-hmm. in the old term, and Mexico has always been run by local strongmen. Part of the central reason for the violence right now is because under the PRI, the chiefs were all kind of controlled by their governors, who were controlled by the president. It was a system of power where the money bribes could flow up like gas and the exercise of power could go down like water, and things were held together. And part of that system of corruption was drug cartels and drug traffickers. With the change to democracy, this great change to democracy, the celebrations we saw from 2000, in the same way that right now in Egypt or Tunisia they're celebrating new democracy, we saw a fragmentation of the system of corruption. And we saw different political parties controlling different states and controlling different municipalities and different police forces. So we've seen a real breakdown now where you often have certain municipal presidents or state governors or state police forces or factions of these allied to specific drug cartels and sometimes actively fighting each other. So often, we see the federal police going into an area, they go into a city, the first thing they do is arrest a bunch of the municipal police, the first people. So, yeah, we see a lot of conflict because of that.
Well, particularly in the state of Guerrero, surely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been some really bloody incidents there, and that would seem to probably be the outgoing caciques fighting or destabilizing the PRD government that's in power, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think you have a lot of different local situations, like in Guerrero, right. Michoacán, Tamaulipas.
Well, there've been massacres in Acapulco hideous ones.
Yeah, I mean Acapulco itself has got its own particular story of conflict. That Acapulco has always been an important place for the drug traffickers, an important place to move the drugs across that part of the Pacific, an important place for marijuana grown in the mountains around there, a place where drug traffickers like to buy nice big houses and to party there, an important place for its local drug market where people in nightclubs like to take cocaine or whatever. So you had a bunch of reasons, and because of the attacks on the drug cartels by the government of Felipe Calderón, you saw the power in Acapulco fragment. On one drug trafficker who was very powerful across Mexico was Arturo Beltrán Leyva, the Barbas, or the Beard, this bearded trafficker from the hills of Sinaloa, who was very powerful in Acapulco. And when he was taken down, shot dead by Marines in the city of Cuernavaca in December 2009, his empire really fell apart. So you had a whole bunch of people fighting for power there, and Acapulco really has become a very bloody front in the war in Mexico.
So, Johan Grillo, is it possible that these drug wars that have caused 40,000 casualties and have, as you describe in your new book, El Narco, that inside Mexico's criminal insurgency, you use that word that we're familiar with from Iraq. Is it possible that at some point or other, with this fratricide going on amongst drug gangs, that one drug gang will survive, there'll be a last man standing, and then the government will make a deal with that person? Is that where we're heading?
I think on a national level, it's very hard to have one single drug cartel. Mexico's a very big country. Right now, we can talk about seven different drug cartels. And to understand really what these cartels are, they're like federations. They're not like always a top-down company. When the work I've done in interviewing members of drug cartels, and when you look and break down other testimonies from inside, they're very much these kind of loose federations. But right now you have seven. I think it's very, very hard to have one last man standing. I think whenever you take down one big boss like Beltrán Leyva or Tony Tormenta or Nazario Moreno or various other bosses that have been shot dead in recent years, people just start moving in and fighting over their empires, fighting over their turfs. So it's only created more and more violence. Mm-hmm. And it's been impossible to take it all down like they took down Pablo Escobar in Colombia back in 1993.
But El Chapo Guzman seems to be a real survivor though, doesn't he?
El Chapo Guzman is an immensely powerful figure, and his name is immensely powerful across Mexico. It's always very hard to know really how... no one knows how much money he really makes or how many men he really has under his command. His name has taken on a massively symbolic meaning. He's become, this mythological, powerful godfather. But then, even Chapo Guzman is not powerful, for example, in Tamaulipas state so much. In other parts of the east, he's got still certain parts of Mexico where his dominance is much, much stronger.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the characters that you portray in your new book, Johan Grillo, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. There's this character, Gonzalo, who you spent time with, and he, and we've heard of the Zetas, these former military and police officials, with their own cartel, a particularly violent one. But you point out that the path from a policeman to a criminal is alarmingly common in Mexico, and mention a whole bunch of these people. And in the 1990s, traffic has flourished. In effect, what happened was the so-called victory in the war on drugs in Colombia freed up Mexico and made it. And isn't that happening in a kind of domino, grim kind of domino way? My understanding is Honduras is very, very much under the control of narcos, and that Guatemala is in fact a criminal state.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've long talked in terms of the drug war about this balloon idea, that when you grab a part of the balloon, it inflates somewhere else. So when you grab the balloon in Colombia, it inflates in Mexico. If you put pressure on Mexico, it will go off in Guatemala. Because, you put pressure on Guatemala, it could go off in Honduras. But we've seen now this escalation and the way that the drug cartels have created increasingly violent militias. You know, this path we've seen. Whereas back in the 1990s, a lot of the guys who were down in close by here in Tijuana, for example, were gangbangers. They actually imported from the United States. People who grew up in ghettos in the United States, so of Mexican origin, were going to Mexico and work as hitmen. And they were, gangbangers with shaved heads and tattoos using handguns. And these days, they're former Mexican special forces, former Guatemalan special forces working as mercenaries, people with, RPGs, grenades, working like military units. So we've seen this incredible escalation, and it's kind of, right now, it's very bad across the hemisphere. I mean, yeah, Guatemala is being hit very hard. Honduras is being hit very hard. And it's a problem we really have to look at across the hemisphere. And this problem that we see in Mexico could well emerge in other countries. There's a lot of other countries also on a knife edge.
But this character that Gonzalo that you profile, who has become born again in the prisons and you portray him as actually being genuinely seeking redemption. He's almost embodies the changes, because in his career as a drug, as a narco, he's seen these changes take place. And now we're basically having heavily armed troops in urban warfare against rival gangs. Mass kidnappings. He was controlling safe houses with dozens of victims bound and gagged. What's particularly grim, though, is the descriptions of beheading people. I mean, that's the part of it that is just almost incomprehensible. The level of barbarity keeps the bar keeps being raised.
That's right. The kind of terror they've unleashed and the idea of beheading. I mean, beheading, it really grabs attention. I mean, somebody who's decapitated is no more dead than somebody who's shot dead and isn't decapitated. But
when they're decapitated, when they're alive,
yeah, sure.
That's pretty
very, sharp. Very powerful symbols sent out to people. And people wonder where the beheading came from. It began only in 2006. We first started seeing beheading in Mexico and then started expanding very rapidly across the country. And it may have been, the time people were watching Al-Qaeda videos, which were very popular to watch on the internet and so forth, and were shown on Mexican TV. Also, some of the Guatemalan mercenaries had committed decapitations in the civil war in that country to try and sow terror into villages who supported leftist guerrillas. I think what you see with the use of this kind of terror and to make sense of it is the drug cartel militias are thinking like armies trying to control territories. They're not thinking like regular people or just like even like regular criminals. They're thinking like armies trying to control territories. How do you control a territory? You sow terror. You stop the public, intervening with you. And you try and show to rivals you're the strongest team. If you leave a body of 12 corpses, you're also sending a message to the street that you're the force who's most to be feared in this area. So I think to make sense of this, that's why we have to see this in terms of an armed conflict. And to find a way out of this, we have to say, how do you get out of an armed conflict? Is it through peace processes? We have to understand an extraordinary situation, and that regular law enforcement isn't necessarily going to solve this thing.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Joan Grillo, the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency.
sucks too long for your ass to go. Like old Cortez, gonna lose your soul. Turn on this man into Diablo. Don't trade your soul for no ass to go. And never buy nothing from a man named True. Never buy nothing from a man named True. Look at my.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm continuing the conversation with Joan Grillo, who's here with me in the studio. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Well, isn't a part of the answer the fact that here we are in the United States pretending to be the piano player in the whorehouse? We're pretending that, all of this stuff is going on south of the border, and it has nothing to do with us because we're a law-abiding society. But we are the customers for these drugs. It is American drug consumers' money that's fueling this war, not to mention the fact that high-powered weapons are readily available on in gun stores in the border areas of the United States and are sold across the border and end up in killings and even killings of American drug enforcement agents. Now we're learning just in Tuesday's New York Times, a front-page story saying that now the U.S. law enforcement people are infiltrating Mexico and not even telling the Mexican law enforcement authorities that they are trying to infiltrate these gangs. So there's a massive level of distrust between the United States and Mexico, and there is this unbelievable attitude in the United States consistent with this illusory war on drugs, that somehow this is Mexico's problem, not our problem, and that we will never, ever seriously talk about demand.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the question of American drug policy and a failed American drug policy has to be in the same debate as the discussion over the Mexican drug war. There's $30 billion, we believe, going every year from American consumers of crystal meth, marijuana, cocaine and heroin to these cartels, and that money goes directly to pay for the assassins, for corrupting police forces, for corrupting politicians, for paying for safe houses and guns and ammunition, which also in a large part come from the United States. So yeah, we'll have to see how that plays out. There is a debate in this country about legalizing marijuana. There could be states legalizing marijuana in the coming years, and that will affect Mexican drug cartels. That will take away money from Mexican drug cartels and could be a very important factor in changing the situation in Mexico. About the use of the undercover informants or generally of the American prosecution policy against drug traffickers, the Mexicans are obviously very suspicious about the American tactics. The American tactics with trying to bust drug gangs have become very dirty in their nature. In the book, I profile an undercover agent of the DEA who infiltrated the Medellin cartel and another cartel in Mexico. And, you know, you see the way they work with paid informants. I mean, it's the logic of trying to bust drug traffickers. It's a very difficult game trying to bust drug traffickers. It inevitably leads to the kind of espionage that we've seen, which, when it comes out, starts creating a lot of tension between the countries.
So how has this affected you, Joan Grillo, again, the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency? You obviously spent a lot of time, and you say here, I've watched too many videos of the pain caused by killers like Gonzalo, this fellow that you profile. I've seen a sobbing teenager tortured on tape. sent to his family, a bloodied old man confessing that he had talked to a rival cartel, a line of kneeling victims with bags over their heads being shot in the brain one by one. I mean, this is just hideous even to think about, let alone to witness.
Well, certainly. I mean, like I mentioned then, watching a lot of this stuff on video, where this war has often been fought on video.
These are police videos that you've seen.
Often police videos. But then again, I think really, and we can talk about all of Mexico, the whole Mexican public has been very traumatized by these images and this situation in the last few years. I mean, you can, in fact, find a lot of these videos on the internet, and you can see they've got 2 million, 3 million, 4 million hits. There's a lot of very, you know, violent videos out there. Sometimes you get privy to police videos. Later, the police will release them to show how bad these criminals are and to show what they can do. But I think the Mexican public generally has been really traumatized by this. Obviously, it creates a lot of distrust in communities. It creates communities that are afraid to give any information about what they're doing, about, you know, even members of their family, about their business, about their income, because they're very scared about what could happen. So you've seen, you know, many people who have suffered from this. It's some difficult situation to deal with. And as journalists, it's our job to look at this, to understand this, and to make sense of what is going on in this country.
So, Joan Grillo, again, the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. What is the answer here? Obviously, we don't have any answers here to our economic problems. We have a dysfunctional, broken government, and we're entering a political season. I don't know where he is in. Is Cencio Calderon? How much has he got left in his 6-year term?
He's going to be out of power at the end of November 2012. The election's mm-hmm. July next year. There'll be a new president elected, and so it's kind of the next administration. I put the answers or the solutions in three areas. The first is in law enforcement. I think Mexico has more than 2,000 municipal police forces, 31 state police forces, plus the federal police, Marines, Army, and so forth. They're not only not working together, they're often actively fighting each other. Now, Felipe Calderon...
A lot of them are very penetrated, aren't they?
A lot of them are very corrupt. I mean, a lot of you have local police forces. You have local police forces as well, these small municipal police forces in these towns. The drug cartel arrives and they're completely overwhelmed. They've got, you know, you have like police forces with like, you know, 20 guys with small guns and then 50 guys roll up with heavy arms. You know, what can they do against these guys? Mm-hmm. So they're overwhelmed.
But isn't there a fundamental choice that a decent, honest policeman in Mexico faces? And it's called plomo y plata, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Silver or lead. That's your choice.
Yeah.
You take a bribe or you take a bullet.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's exactly right.
Who the hell's going to, do the right thing under those conditions?
Yeah, exactly right. So basically, I mean, on this track, I agree with President Felipe Calderon. His proposal, he's tried to expand the federal police. It still has a long way to go. But he has a proposal, a bill in Congress to really reform the police forces and to start having unified single commands to get police forces wearing the same uniform and in the same structure and basically get rid of all the municipal police forces and start dealing with 31 state police forces, which are also in good coordination with the federal command. I think that may be the way forward. The future for Mexico has to really reform the police and create some decent institution, maybe modeled on the Colombian National Police Force, which has been effective. They've been very good about stopping kidnapping and that kind of thing. So that could be one way forward. The second policy area I think is very important is about helping the communities where drug cartel hitmen and traffickers are recruited from. I've done a lot of work in the barrios and the neighbors of Ciudad Juarez, where you find young men, teenagers, who start working for drug cartels, often for low wages. Now, a terrifying fact is that young men in Ciudad Juarez will commit a murder for 1,000 pesos, about $85. That is the price they will commit a murder today.
Now, is that an initiation kind of murder? In other words, how does it work?
It's the way they're recruited, and often they begin to be recruited when they're even younger, 14, 15 or younger. Often a drug cartel will come to them and say, look, if we give you a cell phone and we'll give you, you know, $50 a week or $30 a week in a cell phone and just call us about what vehicles are going past. And then from there, they begin to, you know, get a gun and move up in the organization. But then some of these guys, they're not all millionaire traffickers. You find guys who are arrested and they're earning like things like, you know, they're on a payroll of like $500 a month and they're committing a whole bunch of murders for these guys. So like, how come the government or society can't compete with that? And you find that even throughout all of this conflict, nobody's doing any work in these neighborhoods. You know, even everyone's saying, or the government's saying, oh, we've got to help these neighborhoods, nothing gets up there. Now, there's some great social workers independent social workers up there in these neighbourhoods who work on this, and they get very little resources. And it doesn't take much. I mean, if a kid is prepared to commit a murder for $100, it shows what a desperate kind of life he's got. It doesn't take much, a bit of input, a bit of investment in them and their future to give them some kind of possibility in life. And, you know, America gives $1.6 billion in the Murder Initiative in the form of Black Hawk helicopters and guns, which has, you know, helped intensify the conflict in some ways. And, you know, a few million dollars to these communities could perhaps really help them. And in the last area of policy, I think we have to look at drug policy reform. We'll see how that plays out in a few years, but that as well could help ease the situation and help less money go to drug cartels.
What's extraordinary, though, when you talk about Ciudad Juarez right there on the U.S. border, is the kid that kills somebody for $80 so that the shot can be heard in the United States. I mean, it's that close. Yeah. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, you sit in these neighborhoods and you watch American TV. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a place in some ways between, you know, two countries, between two worlds. Many of the families of these people have come from the countryside. They've broken their family roots. You know, the whole community where they used to live with the grandparents around and the great-grandparents and aunts and uncles, to a more alien environment where they have American TV, have this consumer culture, and have the American guns flooding into these communities.
Mm. So just to, finally then, Johan Grillo, if you have the U.S., you know, with this failed war on drugs, it's been metastasized into this vast bureaucracy, and it's like the gun lobby or the military industrial complex, whatever it is, there's nothing you can do about it, realistically. You know, there's too many rice bowls involved. There's too many paychecks involved. There's too much vested interest to show any imagination. But, you know, is the only sense being spoken tends to come from the south of the border, the countries that are actually dealing with the problems created by our demand here in the United States for drugs. So is there anything in that you think will ever happen in terms of you know, breaking through this kind of rigid, you know, I mean, it fits Einstein's definition of insanity. If you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome, then that is the definition of insanity, and that's the way I see it.
Well, things could definitely change. I mean, like you said, many of the presidents south of the border, the ex-presidents, are now coming out and saying, you know, not just Vicente Fox, Ernesto Zedillo as well, the ex-president of Colombia, Cesar Gaviria, Cardoso, the ex-president of Brazil, who came out and from their experience in power said, well, you know, we oversaw administrations trying to fight drug gangs and we think it's an insurmountable task. If these gangsters keep on getting money from selling to consumers, they're going to keep on fighting. And we have to look at change here. They're beginning, you know, to raise their voice. We need obviously active presidents to make their voice heard on this, to maybe see policy change more effectively. People tend to be very scared to talk about this when they're in power because of the political consequences. When they get out of power, they start talking. But in terms of U.S. drug policy, I mean, that's obviously a debate that has to happen here in the United States, has to happen in Europe, has to happen at the United Nations. But I think there is movement in this debate, and I think things can change. And I don't, you know, say this is a non-starter. I think it's now becoming a debate that's being more and more open. I think a debate we definitely need to have in connection with the bloodshed going on in Mexico right now.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us in the studio today, Johan Grillo.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Johan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. And he has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. And his new book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Whoa, man. Tell the stories to me.
mind.